Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick and Mark.
Hello.
Hey.
We have a great show for you today. We were going to do a review of 13th Age Glorantha, but if you've listened to our interview with Rob and Jonathan and how much larger the 13th Age Glorantha book is, we could not pack it into a single episode of our normal runtime. So we're going to try and get through it in two. It may spill over into three, but today we're going to look at the player-focused rules of 13th Age Glorantha and why you as a player will want to pick up this PDF or this book when it comes out. Again, if you want more information on this product, we've done two episodes already. In season one, episode 5 was our initial interview about the book, and then our first episode of season 2 was our interview with Rob and Jonathan about the book as its PDF is out in the wild and soon the print book. And I cannot wait. We will post pictures on the Iconic Google Plus. For the players, what does 13th Age Glorantha have? It has a ton. You have two new races, the Ducks and the Trolls. You have three new human variants, in addition to the quick-to-fight variant, which is kind of the standard Dragon Empire. You have five completely new classes, and you have four transformational classes, which we'll talk about later. And then at the back of the book, if you're playing in Glorantha, the appendix has each of the standard 13th Age classes and how they can work into Glorantha. So if you're following along at home, we're going to be covering chapters 1, 2, and 4 today, just kind of the introduction to Glorantha, the making the character, and the classes, because that's like 200 pages plus of the book. So chapter 1 is the intro to Glorantha. And Mark and Nick, you guys are coming basically like no understanding of Glorantha, save what we've discussed on the show.
Pretty much. I'm quite the Glorantha virgin.
So as completely fresh to the setting, how did chapter 1 hold up for you?
Well, really, the only experience I have with Glorantha, apart from, you know, doing the interviews and reviews and such for this podcast, was a play by post that I had started kind of playing in. And so I opened up this book with really having very little.
All right. You played in my HeroQuest game, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chapter one really grabbed me and sold me on it. It's a 50,000 foot view of the world, the gods, the history, the peoples, their hopes, their fears, future possibilities, and in very broad strokes tells the story of the three ages, how they shaped where things are at today, and really sets the stage for that a convergence of the mortals' potential that the gods of themselves never accounted for.
Yeah, I liked it. Good explanation of the history. As Nick said, I liked because having looked into this a little bit since we're starting on it, I know in your home, the world map hangs on a whole wall. They narrow down this focus to the Dragon Pass, which I think is really good. It's not, hey, I've had this huge world. Let me tell you about it in 500 pages, thoroughly confuse you, give you too many options. They focus on the Dragon Pass, the races and cultures there. And I like that the way it focuses kind of what you're going to do to start, and hopefully they expand this to other areas, but it kind of helps with the overview. It starts big and kind of narrows down to just the Dragon Pass, which I like.
Well, just so you know, that giant 6 picture frame map on my wall is just the northern continent of Glorantha. There's still the whole southern one and all the adjacent isles.
Well, and even in the narrowing down of the Dragon Pass, I mean, they make a call out of basically saying your Glorantha may vary. And, you know, this is what we've kind of structured it for, but we're also keeping in line with the open-endedness of 13th Age and what you guys are exploring and discovering and the stories that you're telling inside of the Dragon Pass. It's going to be your own and it's unique and it's okay.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I think they definitely leave it open. If you're an old Glorantha fan and you're playing somewhere else, here's how we structured this. It's very easy to go, well, and I don't know the other cultures or races, but you can go somewhere else, use their rules. They've given you a good basis, very good explanations, and you can go play somewhere else if that's where you're at in Glorantha.
Yeah, I think that as somebody who's played, or at least, I mean, I've run a number of Glorantha games. I've read a lot more than I've run. It's always one of those settings that I think I keep referring to it as my white whale, because when I wanted to get into Glorantha, everyone else wanted to play D20 fantasy. Like they all wanted to play D&D. And that's cool. Like, you know, we jumped into it and I ran a couple of one shots with third edition and didn't really fit. And I really wanted to try RuneQuest. I have a bunch of the RuneQuest material. And you know what? I can get people to play Call of Cthulhu with D100, but I couldn't get them to play Glorantha with D100. And now I'm planning on using 13th Age as kind of my gateway drug into Glorantha, because it's the D20 fantasy that my players know and love and want to get involved with, a setting that I have just adored for a very long time. You know, as someone who is familiar with Glorantha, this is all information that we kind of have had before, but it is concise and told in a new and exciting way that sets you up well for understanding the scope of what Rob and Jonathan are trying to do with this game, how their base Glorantha has varied. So the Chaos Rising setting is not a setting that, or even an idea necessary, that has been explored in the published Glorantha products. So coming to it, even as an old hand, you're given a new take on the setting. You're actually given a take that Mark and I were talking about beforehand, where Mark's like, how do you involve trolls into a group of Orlanthi? Well, the setting kind of allows everything's coming apart. And if you listen to our previous interview with Rob and Jonathan, they kind of did that on purpose, or at least it was an unintentional benefit of doing the Chaos Rising, because you don't have, you know, they talk about it in Glorantha terms. I know it from playing in Forgotten Realms, where you get the one guy at the table who's like, that's not how that works in the realms. Well, guess what? Everything's falling apart. Chaos is breaking in. That is how we're doing it in this game of Glorantha. And it allows old and new players to kind of come to it and find something new.
Very good.
Any other thoughts on the initiation chapter?
No, they're very good explaining things. And I do like that explanation of, yeah, this is why the norm isn't the norm anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, I will say, like, and I just wrapped up a home game of 13th Age Glorantha that we played through 9 levels, I think. I wanted to see how it worked with a more traditional Gloranthan setting. And so I ran through the Hero Quest, most of the Sartar campaign, which is a very much more traditional, you know, it was designed for Hero Quest. It was designed for before the Hero Wars really start. And it worked great. Like, I mean, I had to make a couple of changes and allowances, but I was able to take existing Glorantha material and convert the story with very little effort.
Good. Well, yeah, the only other thing that I had as a thought coming out of that chapter one is that I would love to see that chapter as a free preview for the rest of the book. Because I think if, as both as a player and as someone who's looking at maybe running in that game, you know, it's easy to look at a book and say, yes, it has this many new classes and this many new races and this many new magic items and monsters. And a lot of times those sorts of products and those sorts of advertisements just start blending in together. But if I were able to have taken that chapter one and gotten it before shelling out the little bit of money that it costs and read through it. I mean, when I read through it, I was very inspired by it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, after reading this, I know I already have the rest of the PDF, but I would go buy the PDF after reading that.
That's interesting. Yeah, that would be a great way to, and I know they have different ways of introducing people to Glorantha. Like one of the other books that was part of the initial Kickstarter is a Gloranthan source book that is a, hey, here's a primer on the world. And it's less than the gorgeous Guide to Glorantha, a little bit more portable, a little bit more usable. But I think that it may even still be at 160, 200 pages, whatever it is, not as inspiring or heart-catching as that first initiation chapter. You're right. It's just like, here it is in a condensed form that doesn't take long to get through, and you know what you need to know to start gaming. Well, the second chapter, because we know you all love mechanics, is how to create characters in 13th Age Glorantha. And it's a little bit, I mean, it's almost identical to 13th Age. As Rob and Jonathan stated, this is not 2.0. This is still 13th Age. So the two main things that are in this chapter, not counting the races, you got a new stat array for just saying, sit down, let's play here. Here are the stats, assign them, and runes, which we'll talk about later. Runes in Glorantha replace icons, because runes are these fundamental kind of building blocks, inspirations, and wells of power that pervade the Glorantha universe. The gods fight over them or possess them. Humans can be touched by them. Tribes and people are touched by them. You guys, as players, will get three, and those may not always be the three that you get, and we'll kind of get into that a little bit later. But let's talk about what kind of races we have in here. So we start with the four human cultures, and the Hortling culture is basically identical to the humans of the Dragon Empire, right, Mark?
Yes. Humans start when you're generating plus two to any ability score, you get your bonus feat, and you're going to get one cultural trait. And I really like these cultural traits. Like Jam said, Hurtling are closest to what you have in the Dragon Age, but you also have the Esrolian culture trait. They're resilient people, so you get to pick if you want physical or mental defense or a slightly less physical and mental defense bonus on it.
Yeah, so you get plus two to one or plus one to both.
Plus two to one or plus one to both. Earth-centered kind of people. Hurtlings are quick to fight. Descendants of the great Orlanthi culture. The Praxian culture trait is survivor, which allows you to increase the number of your recoveries by one, and your recovery dice are one size larger. So D12, 2D6. 2D6 would be 2D8.
Yeah.
So that's a big thing.
Makes your character a lot more resilient.
Yes. I wish my old crusader had that.
That's right.
He was the glass jaw.
Well, and here's the thing. Like all of these human cultures can very easily be ported into the Dragon Empire.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
At least traits. You could just give a list of the traits.
And, yeah. Say you're from this area. This is what you get. And then the Tarshite culture trait, advancing. They get, each time you gain a level, you get an immediate incremental advance. The disadvantage is when everyone else gets that incremental, you don't get it.
So you start off a little bit better at each level.
You should start a little bit better. It kind of just depends. Like I always say when people are creating a character is first thought before you even pick, well, it might come with the race, but what do you want to play? Mm-hmm. You want to play a mage? You want to play a fighter? Do you want to play the rogue type, the trickster? And then kind of narrow it down. Then, okay, is there a particular race you want to be? Some people, I could see, I don't know if you limited, but when people were looking at this on your homebrew, I want to play a troll. So you have a whole party of trolls running around because that's the new race. That's usually how it works. So you can mix and match, kind of think of what you want to do. Do you want to be tougher, be resilient? Do you want to be quick to the fight? Do you want to advance quicker, or do you want to have better recoveries?
Yeah. What do you guys think of the cultural traits?
I like them. That's one of those. I made a note of mine. I like the cultural traits instead of, okay, you're a duck, you're a troll, you're a human. Well, now there's four different types of humans, so they're different.
Right, and depending if you have on how four you play. If you got four humans at the table, not having them all being quick to fight.
And if you don't want the quick to fight and you want to have better physical and mental defenses, you can pick that. Mm-hmm. Depends on the kind of character you want to play.
It also makes your cultural choice an important consideration.
Yes, it should. I said so many fantasy games, humans are humans, not... No, will you start with something different because of where you grew up? And to make a note of, you know, under other humans, that just because you're Esrolian doesn't mean you have to look just like them. Just that's the culture you're from. Mm-hmm. Somewhere in the past, your ancestors were probably that, but you don't have to be. And I don't know all the differences in Glorantha terms between these, but you don't have to be exactly that.
Yeah.
What's your first looks?
I like the fact that they're different. I know that as a human, you get a plus two to basically, you know, whichever, was it skill stat?
Ability modifier.
To whatever.
Or ability score.
Plus two ability score and a bonus feat.
So you get a plus two to your ability score. And that difference in your humanness comes out at the time that you're creating your character. And that's the only time it would come out otherwise. So if you're in a 13th age game and everyone's human, then there's not going to be that much variance between them. It's all going to be hinged on whatever class it is. But in this case, the culture that you're from is also just as important of a decision as whatever the class is that as well, because it does give you that extra feat that, or it gives you that extra ability that you can leverage, which factors in not only to the combat or the role play that's taking place at the table, but also the story that's being created too. You've got these disparate cultures that are coming together for something.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Cool. Well, the next one is the trolls, and specifically the dark trolls. They, instead of giving you your normal plus two, which I liked because it makes them stand out a little bit more, you get a plus three to either strength or con. But those two abilities, strength and con, always have to be within your top three ability scores. Yep. So trolls, they're just tougher and stronger than humans. And mechanically, we're going to reinforce that.
That's good.
I also like how they have two racial abilities that depend on whether your initiative die is even or odd. And I know the designers of 13th Age love playing with that as a trigger. Like if the die rolls even, if the die roll is odd, it was really interesting to see it come into play with the trolls. What are your guys' initial thoughts or what are your guys' thoughts on the trolls?
It definitely something you have to keep track of.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like that the way it's, depending if it's even or odd, you get either your Dark Walk or Big Eater.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to track it. So that's one of the things I liked. And their whole character creation is their advice on this is a little more difficult than that.
Mm-hmm.
Be careful of the player. If you all have that indecisive player who can't handle too much or can't do the quick decision, they probably shouldn't play the very complicated characters. You just slow down the whole table and everyone suffers.
Yeah. As a player, I like variance. So I think the idea of having each combat encounter be that much different based on whatever you roll for initiative, I like that. It was very appealing to me. It is a lot to remember. And after, you know, if you were to play three battles and each time that you rolled and got the Big Eater ability, in the back of your mind, you're just going to naturally be thinking, well, this is my ability. And then battle number four, you're like, oh, I have Dark Walk. How am I going to use that now?
I mean, it's not too bad.
No.
It, especially if you're doing like a troll, I think a troll warrior or berserker or something like that. Not it complicates if you take the Hellmother
mm-hmm.
or some of the other ones have a lot more other things going on. Especially Dark Walk, I would like, yeah.
What I did was I used initiative cards mm-hmm. to keep track of everything. And when I filled out the troll ones, I had a note on the card that said, ask them whether, you know, just even or odd. And so I could say, you know, Mark gives me his initiative. And if he's playing a troll, I would, as I put his card in the stack, I'm like, oh, even or odd. Oh, okay. Yeah, right. Odd. I get this ability. So it was a way as the GM to just have just something simple to remind. Because it only happens once a fight. I had two troll players out of eight characters. Wasn't that much. Like, it didn't add anything to my normal initiative practice. And then
that's something I would throw back on the player, though. I mean, mm-hmm. you've got a lot going on to remember. Remember if you're even or odd. If you forget, I guess you don't get your little racial bonus. And you miss out on being able to pop off the map and pop in somewhere else.
Of course, mm-hmm. that's true of all racial bonuses.
Yeah, it's just
you have to remember. You know,
I got five people at the table. I can't remember all of your bonuses. I'll try to help when we start, but after a while, you have to remember.
To only have
stuff.
Five people at the table.
Yes, we only have five people constantly.
The other, and it's a Glorantha staple, and I, you know, for those of you who don't like them, just skip ahead about 5 minutes. But the ducks made it into 13th Age Glorantha. They are that idiosyncratic, strange, doesn't fit really anywhere. I've heard it likened before to halflings or hobbits, where you have, like in Middle Earth, you have all of these tall races going around and they all seem to fit. And then you have hobbits and you don't really know where they're from or, you know, what's going on with them. That's the ducks in Glorantha. They are the epitome of, hey, there's some weirdness in this, and this is going to be one of those things that you just kind of run head into.
Yes, and if you listen to episode one,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't, I would say, not their choice, but it was heavily fan requested that ducks be included.
Yeah, it was something that,
you know, don't yell at Jonathan.
Wasn't just the book that came out of the Kickstarter. The stuff that was in the book also came as a result of the Kickstarter, because it probably wouldn't have made the cut otherwise.
Oh, man. I'm glad that it did. Duck fan forever. So what do you guys think of the duck as a player choice?
I thought it was really interesting. I think going into it, I was expecting it to just, I don't know. I don't know what to expect with a duck as a player race. But, you know, the depiction they made of it being a very, a kind of a darker race, a lot, their history is beset by tragedy and curses and who knows what else. And they're looked down upon by the rest of the world.
Yet they're doing this very important thing about keeping all of these undead trapped in this marsh.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then that's balanced by the fact that they're ducks and they waddle and they squawk and they have feathers. And it's in a really odd combination.
I kind of like their idea of the only true Humakti.
Yeah.
We have separated ourselves from humanity.
Yeah. There's
on purpose.
They do a lot of interesting, here's some options.
Yes.
Especially with, so as we're talking about options, you know, you have the two there are two racial abilities that you get to choose from. One of them, it plays up the dark Humakti nature of this, where basically if the creature's wounded and almost dead, you get to reroll if it's under a certain level. Great. Totally, I mean, changes a lot of abilities. Could be a swingy thing in the middle of a game. Good, solid racial ability. Then there's the one that shall not be mentioned. For those of you who like to play up the comedic aspect of the ducks, one of you guys want to take this one because it's not going to be me.
Squawk.
So that one, you end up before you make your roll, you decide that whether or not your roll is going to have the opposite effect.
And it doesn't have to be comical. If you're fighting the boss who's got a high AC.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I really have a chance to hit him. You know what? I'm going to squawk because I'm probably going to miss and it'll turn into a hit. Just depends on the flavor of your table. And I would say from GMs, if you're uncomfortable with it, just make it dark.
Yeah. I just have to say the layout and the art of this book might be the best 13th Age product like that we've seen so far. It is a gorgeous book throughout.
It is.
All right. Well, let's talk. Oh,
I will say the artwork reminds me of late 60s.
Bright colors.
Bright colors, Nehru jackets and such.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So the other big change is instead of icons, we have runes. And we talked a little bit about that. Now, you as a player, you're going to start with three. Two come from your class or your god, and then one's a free one. Now, without going, we'll talk a little bit more about this in the next episode. But basically, you're only guaranteed to get those runes half the time. So unlike icons where you're rolling three dice at the start of the game, you're only rolling one die at the start of a 13th age session. One through three, you get either rune one, two, or three. And on four through six, a different rune might be influencing your character's adventure. Now, there are mechanical bonuses of rolling a rune that you don't have. And we'll get into that with Hero Quest gifts. But the other difference is you are guaranteed for that rune, for one rune to happen every session. Yes, and there's times where you get to reroll them. So if you don't like the rune you got and you go into the hero plane, you haven't used it, you get to reroll. That's awesome. But unlike 13th Age, where sometimes your dice just hate you and you get no icon relationships for, I think you're at 2 months now, Nick? Two sessions, I mean?
No, I'm at three sessions rolled a single icon.
Yeah. You are guaranteed to have
your icons disowned you.
That's right. We're playing that up a little bit.
Just a little bit.
In 13th Age Glorantha, you go into this session knowing I may not know what rune I get to narrate, but I'm definitely going to get to narrate a rune. And they're a little bit more broad in scope, and they give you a lot of examples. You were talking about that earlier, Mark, before the show. Like all the
yes, I love the way they put this book together and the examples. And it's not just here's runes, here's an example of one. They give you an example for every single one. So even if somebody's new to this, it's not hard to get through it and right. understand what they're talking about, which right. I really like.
Well, and the other aspect of the runes that I like, and I've actually turned into my core default way to handle icons as well. When you narrate a rune, you're guaranteed for it to go off the way you want it to. And then the GM rolls a D20. And on a 1 through 5, he gets to complicate it somehow. And so that's how I run icons now. I do 5s and 6s, generate an icon relationship. And when you use it, I roll a D5 or D20 after I roll a D5. And if I get a 1 through 5, my games are hard.
And that's huge for the players because I know that with fives, players have a tendency to be so afraid of what that complication might be that they just don't use the icon relationship point mm-hmm. at all. And where in this case, it's I've got this boon, I'm going to take it, and I might have something happen as a result of it, but I don't know.
Right. And that's what I have found at both tables, the Dragon Empire and the Glorantha game, is that people are much more willing to step out there and get crazy with their rune or their icon because they know that it's going to go off. They don't know if it's going to be complicated. And the complications have been just as fun.
Yeah, I never had a problem. I always thought complications were fun, so I never shied away from fives.
Every time our player used his moon rune, it really blew up in the entire party's face in a spectacularly glorious fashion.
15. Yeah, so there's lots of runes. You have to read through them, read the examples. Mm-hmm. I think they're great.
Yeah.
Little player twist.
The thing is, as we'll show in the next episode, all of your magic is going to come from the runes, and you may get blessings that don't necessarily correspond to the runes that you have, but the runes and the HeroQuest gifts that you get over a campaign are the scars, the accretion of what has been happening with the game to your character. And I think that when in my 13th Age Galantha game, the Humakti, who worships death, got a life boon because of HeroQuest gifts, that was a huge... It was a huge moment for them. What does this mean that I'm now blessed by life? All right, so we're going to look at classes next because classes are the core of the mechanical side for players in 13th Age. And there are a ton of classes and class variants and transformation classes in this book. So as I mentioned before, if you're playing 13th Age Glorantha and you want to bring one of the core 13th Age classes or 13 True Ways classes into Glorantha, check out the appendix. Just flip right there. Ton of great ideas. New class-wise, there are five, you could argue six, new classes. There's the Berserker class, which is split up between Stormbull and Zoroxaron. So a troll Berserker and an Orlanthe, technically, or Praxian Berserker. And what I love about that class is for a class that is all about chaos, it is a mechanically, you have to be very focused and well thought out player to play this out of control warrior. It is a very interesting juxtaposition. And just, I had a Stormbull at my table. And so one of the main Stormbull mechanics is you're setting up your Berserker die. Like when at the start of every round, you roll a Berserker die and that becomes your bonus instead of the escalation die. And your powers trigger off what you roll. So do you put some powers when you're only getting a plus one? Do you get some powers when you're getting a plus six or seven? It's a really interesting class.
Not to worry. They have examples for it again.
They do. They have tons of examples in this book. The Earth Priestess is perhaps for me the best example. I'm trying to think of a different case, but it might be the best example of a class that is designed to work the way the world says it would work. Arnaldo, the Earth Goddess, has a number of different myths where she is married a lot of the different gods and heads of pantheons throughout Glorantha. And so the main Earth Priestess mechanic are these favors of the Earth, where she basically says, all right, champions, next person to do X gets my favor. And the next player at the table who does that gets the favor of the Earth Goddess. And they're fantastic. Like our Earth Priestess ended up, I mean, it ended up being a little card that we would set up, like, all right, here's what everyone is looking for. And sometimes it would go off on not who we wanted, you know, who the players wanted it to rest on, but it's a great mechanic. And then there's some summoning and some spells in there. The Hell Mother is the troll priestess of Kyger Latour. She's not a nice person. It is a great class. Just again, high level. The Bound Spirits is another great mechanic. You have all of these spirits and they give you a little bonus while you have them bound, or you can release them. And most of them do damage to your allies to then trigger something awesome for your ally. So maybe your ally takes some damage from your spirit, but they get to re-roll with a bonus, or they just get to re-roll.
One other thing about the Hellmother that I thought was really interesting was the concept of a recurring daily spell, where you cast off a spell and then it repeats itself next round without you having to do anything to maintain it. And then if you, depending on what you roll, it may extend a third round or potentially even a fourth round. And that idea of being able to release something and even if you die, have that still have an effect. I thought it was a really brilliant new way to handle the spell casting mechanic.
Definitely a more difficult character. If this is your first time with 13th Age, don't pick a Hellmother.
I actually had a first-time player I think it might have been her second game that she had played ever.
You have to be good at multitasking. Remember, she said multiple spells going off at different, you know, once you cast it and summon spirits and just...
Chalazak had all of her spells color-coded and she had her play space very well organized.
Next time she's going to go back and play a barbarian and be like, well, what am I supposed to do?
And you just roll to hit and do damage.
Hulk smash.
The Humakti is another neat, as Jonathan tweets in our interview, it's his version of the fighter. If the fighter wasn't about protecting somebody, but was about just killing everything. We'll get into what we like about all of them later. And then finally, the last new class is the Trickster, which... sadly, I did not have in this last campaign, but I had in all of my one-shots, and it is your coyote, it is your scapegoat, it is the person that you keep around because all the bad luck is drawn to that person, and his sole job is to make you, the rest of the party, look awesome. He doesn't even do damage. He puts points on monsters that convert to damage when you hit them. So he fumbles and falls to the ground and ties up the troll's legs so that your Orlanthi warrior can look even better when he kills the troll warrior.
Yeah, if on one end of the pendulum swing you've got min-maxing your character, the other end of the pendulum swing is the trickster.
So what did you guys think of the new classes?
Storm, Bull, Berserker.
You want to play one?
Yes.
I would go for the Humakti.
Yeah, or Humakti. I can see that.
It feels like a fighter that hits a lot harder. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I typically kind of naturally gravitate toward those types of classes. And it would be fun to try that at the table. I definitely want to try the whole Death Before Dishonor class talent where the Humakti cannot flee from a fight.
Yeah, everyone else gets to flee and the Humakti gets a pretty beefy bonus. And if he wins, the group doesn't suffer a campaign loss. It's just the end of another fight.
So instead of the conversation going, well, guys, I think it might be time for us to run away. It's like, no, I think it's about time for us to unleash the Humakti.
Yeah. At that point, the rest of the party can go get pizza and sodas. And then the GM does his darndest to kill Nick's character. So another Thursday. So
what would you choose?
From the new classes, all of them, as someone who runs more 13th Age than gets to play 13th Age, I loved the fact that in this last campaign, out of the new classes, I had everyone but the Zerok-Zeron and the Trickster. So I got to see the Storm Bull, the Earth Priestess, the Hellmother, and the Humakti go from level 1 to level 9, and it was spectacular. They were a lot of fun.
Did you kill anybody?
Oh, I killed a lot of people in that game. And I think the final fight on the back of the Crimson Bat saw half the party dead, but they all ended up in the underworld. So the dead players.
So half dead, half insane.
The dead players still get to play out the last part of this adventure, but they don't get to come back. Like,
oh,
that's it. Like they don't even get the heroic revival rules because they rode the Crimson Bat into hell. You follow Rob. He tweeted about this where one of the players called it the reverse meatloaf. They rode the bat into hell as opposed to the bat out of hell. Well, let's talk briefly about the transformation classes and then we'll get into our thoughts and highlights. So what are the transformation classes, Nick?
Well, to start with, there's the monk class, and it's not really a transformational class because it's still called the monk, but it adds a couple more forms, a couple more movements, more uses for your key points. And it was amusing because as I was reading through it, I thought they're kind of describing Captain America. And then I got to the very end and they said, yeah, well, this is based on the idea of Captain America.
Now, one little Easter egg, or at least I think it's an Easter egg. Rob, when you read through if you read through the Escalation edition of 13 True Ways, the designers talk about how they got hung up for a while on the monk trying to make the opening, trying to make all three of the moves into a haiku for each power. And they weren't able to do that, so they had to scrap that idea and just get the monk finished. The monk powers in 13th Age Glorantha are haikus.
Oh, are they really?
I was reading them. I'm like, wait a second. Sweet. They got to do this. So that's a little Easter egg that they managed to slip into the book.
So after the monk, you have the Orlanthi warrior.
And what are the transformational classes, Nick?
So the transformational classes, they are the core classes from 13th Age, whether they're coming from the 13th Age core book or coming from 13th True Ways, and they're adapted to the Gloranthan setting. A little bit more thematic elements to it, a little bit more cultural references or runic references, but they're saying, like, for example, the Orlanthi warrior, they take the barbarian from 13th Age and it's like, well, we could just use the barbarian as it is, but we want to make this interesting to play, so we're going to make it specific to the Orlanthi class. And instead of the warriors going into a rage, they go into a fit of inspiration, mm-hmm. and that inspires them to fight harder, to press harder, to be dealing more damage.
And it works a little different, because instead of the rage, they get basically an extra, once it triggers, they get an extra attack as a quick action every round.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the Orlanthi warrior. The rebel is a transformation from the rogue class.
Getting to see the rebel in play, our rebel's name was Salahuddin, and he he really worked Bravado, which is an upgraded version of one of the rogue's abilities, but always goes off, where he can just do something stupid or something spectacular and it goes off. Between that and opening strike, so instead of sneak attack, the rebel's running around and he gets bonus damage the first time he hits somebody. So he's this very mobile character as opposed to like a positioning character. Great change.
Yeah, and I thought I was fascinated because the rebels have a once per campaign power. So once they hit, I think it's one of their ninth level abilities, they have something called one death where they basically say, I kill this creature and it doesn't matter how many hit points they have left. I slay it. The repercussions from that are one, it can only happen once per campaign. So you want to save it for the right moment. But then the whatever the damage was that monster had been reduced by, however many hundreds of points of HP that just got wiped off the charts, half of that comes back into the next battle and makes that fight that a little bit harder. Mm-hmm. So it's basically saying we've got a real big bad monster. We're done with this one. And we're still going to be dealing with it next battle, but it's not going to be nearly as bad. Anyway, I thought that was a really cool addition they added to the Rebel. The Storm Voice was a transformation from the Sorcerer class. A lot of the same types of mechanics that you're familiar with the Sorcerer, the gathering power, unleashing that power. But a lot of it's more focused on, thematically at least, thunder, lightning. You know, instead of just the Sorcerer power gathering, it's actually storm clouds that are gathering overhead.
Right, and instead of the random energy being like fire or acid, it's very much... And it's cyclical, like you roll initially and then it always moves through the three elements in the same order.
Right. Then you also got the Troll Warrior, which is another transformation from the Barbarian class. And again, instead of going into rage, they go into a frenzy. The thing that I thought was really fascinating about the Troll Warrior is that they grow stronger as the battle progresses. Mm-hmm. The amount of HP available to them increases every single round that you're fighting. In that case, you almost want the battle to be drawn out a little bit longer because the Troll Warrior is going to be that much more powerful.
Yeah.
And then the last one is the Windlord, which is a transformation from the fighter class. And you still have the flexible attacks and variances on what you're able to do based on whatever the die roll is. But then you also have a series of new exploits that you can take advantage of. And it's basically setting yourself up for your next action. It's thematically seeing a weakness in someone's armor. And so next time I'm going to be able to get my sword in there.
Yeah.
There's two other adaptations that are referenced in the back of the book, the Troll Adept and the Troll Necromancer. There's not enough there to really warrant a full fleshing out, but those two are talked about in the back of the book of taking the Druid class from 13th Age and the Necromancer class from 13th Age and bringing it into Glorantha.
So what did you guys think of the new player options in 13th Age Glorantha?
I liked them.
Yeah, I think it would have been very easy for them to just say... And we support all of the 13th Age player classes. But the fact that they took the effort into making them thematic and making them feel like this actually is a part of Glorantha, kudos to them. They did a really good job with it.
What is your what are your guys' favorite class or mechanic that you saw in here?
I was kind of taken with the Stormbolt Berserker. Couldn't think of it.
Yeah.
It's in my tongue. Like the yeah, I don't know. I've always liked that kind of class.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to see played. Again, it's really weird to see. I think the player who chose it wanted something that they didn't have to necessarily think about very much because they're like, oh, a berserker, I'll play that. Oh, what do you mean I have to like set this up? What do you mean I have to be choosing?
Yeah, it's not just roll. You know, it's not just roll smash. Yeah. There are some things to decide, and they give really good examples on helping you so you don't waste your six on that didn't really help.
Yeah.
Set it up to make your guy bad.
Wow. What about you, Nick?
As far as the transformation classes go, I think the Storm Voice is what really grabbed my attention. And I have never played a Sorcerer class before, so I'm not sure how it would actually go down at the table. But thematically, I liked that imagery.
Yeah. All right. So.
What about you?
Oh, I still say the Trickster is my favorite, okay. Like mechanically. Just the way that it captures how the Trickster is portrayed in Glorantha and just the idea that, I mean, he's got an ability called Fuster Cluck and
what do you mean by that?
The dance of slapstick and death. Just the ability to like utterly debase yourself for the benefit of the party. And I have had tricksters, moon lunars. I have had tricksters. We won't, to keep our rating, I will not describe what our tricksters have done, but it is fun to just have this character whose sole purpose at the table is kind of the bad luck magnet. He does strange and bad things so that the rest of the group can progress through the campaign. And I love that. I also like just overall, like the art, again, I got to say again, is just fantastic. All the way the rune mechanics work, all of that is just amazing.
Yeah, I really liked how when they were, every time they reference a rune, they also include the little runic symbol for that as well. I was kind of half expecting the chart at the very beginning of the book to be the only reference for that. But by the time I got done reading at least this much, in my mind, I'm already starting to recognize what they are because it's just prevalent throughout the entire book.
Yeah, that's kind of a Glorantha-ism. Like the runes are almost always, I can't actually think of a situation where they're not portrayed by the symbol and the name of the rune, which kind of helps, again, like you said, reinforce. Because people tattoo themselves with these things. So it's very easy for you to describe a spiral and people go, okay, it's the air rune. So why do you guys as players think that players should pick up this book?
Well, if you like 13th Age and you want to play something a little bit different than the standard, this book goes above and beyond to explain how to create your character. You'll need the 13th Age core rule book on the basic stuff, but how runes work with you, why the gods are important, and what your class does and why. I think it's laid up very nicely.
Yeah. And all of these can be ported back into the Dragon Empire with probably a lot less effort than it takes to port the core Dragon Empire stuff into 13th Age, Glorantha.
My thought on that is I think it would be difficult for a player to pick this up in a vacuum and be able to do much with it. I think there is going to have to be GM buy-in on either taking these, maybe even some of the extra abilities that you get from these transformational classes and saying, I want to play a barbarian, but I really like this thing that the warrior has. Can I bring this over? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're going to have to work with your GM on that. But as far as just general inspiration, I think that players could benefit a lot from this. And certainly being able to go back to your GM and say, this is a fully fledged, published, play tested, officially supported option. Can I please use this? And, you know, maybe even playing the trickster in a Dragon Empire campaign. Although I will say on that one that the trickster, as fun as it looks, it's certainly not for every table or for every player.
That is true. That is very true. You as a player just need to like go in expecting all of that cool stuff that you love about 13th Age characters that you talk about at the end of the game, you know, the massive hits, the amazing roles. Your job is to make everyone else at the table look good by lowering the bar. It is still an amazing class to play, like mechanically, and I would love to play a trickster at the table. You can get this product in PDF at three places. DriveThruRPG has it. Chaosium has it. Pelgrane Press has it as part of their pre-order for the physical book. And I'm going to assume that once the physical book comes out, you're going to be able to order it at Pelgrane Press and Chaosium and get it through your friendly local game store. So from a player's perspective, it sounds like you guys think it's worthwhile to pick up.
Coming in at over 450 pages for less than $30.
Yeah, it's $28, I think.
Yeah, definitely worth picking up.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so in two episodes, we will discuss possibly the entirety of the rest of the book. It's still like 300 pages. Again, as always, thank you to Pelgrane Press and Petri's Family Games for supporting the show. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.